Wake up! Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. You are now listening to You and Me at 30. I'm your host, Dr. Joshua K. Wright. I realize that you could be anywhere in the world right now, but you're here listening to me, and I sincerely appreciate that. You and Me at 30 is a new talk show airing on Sunday mornings. I'll be bringing you lively, thought-provoking discussion on a variety of topics. Each show will feature an extended conversation with a guest. While many of these individuals will come from the University of Maryland Eastern Shore and the local community, I will also feature several guests from around the country. Please note that the views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of 91.3 WESM or the University of Maryland Eastern Shore.
I'm teaching a lesson on World War II in my U.S. History Survey course at UMES right now. When I searched YouTube for a video about women's role in the war, I came across a documentary that received good reviews. So I watched it, and when I finished it, I was very disappointed with the video's whitewashing of the war. There was not a single mention or image of any women of color. Even though Asian, Native American, Latina, and African American women all played significant roles in the war. Unfortunately, Women's History Month remembrances of the war often overlook their story. Today's guest is Mr. Gregory Cook. He's a professor. He's also a director and a producer of a riveting new documentary film, which is titled Invisible Warriors, African American Women in World War II. Professor Cook, thanks so much for joining me this morning.
Thank you, Dr. Wright, for having me. It's my pleasure to be here.
So, Professor, tell me, what was the premise of your documentary, Invisible Warriors?
World War II was the most consequential event in human history. It affected more people, brought in more technological change, and its effects are still reverberating globally today. And so African-American women were major contributors in that consequential event in human history. So there were actually 600,000 African-American women who are dubbed Rosie the Riveters, who actually participated in the war. And their challenge was not so much that they couldn't do the job, but they had to overcome race and gender in order to succeed. They played a major role in the war and in the civil rights movement during and after the war.
So when you use the term Rosie the Riveter, explain what that is.
Most people have seen the image of a white woman flexing. She has on a bandana, red bandana, and she's flexing her bicep. And that image has come to be known as Rosie the Riveter. That image was created during World War II as a motivational factor to get women, parenthetically white women, to come to work in factories, shipyards, etc. So the simple way of looking at it or thinking about Rosie the Riveter is like this. During World War II, any woman who did what was traditionally man's work is considered to be a Rosie the Riveter. My mother was a Rosie. Prior to World War II, a lot of jobs, particularly in the federal government, that we now associate with women, whether you're a clerk, typist, a filer, you know, someone filing like that, those jobs were traditionally held by white males. And when the war came, obviously the white males left to go into the military, and at that point women flooded into the government, particularly in Washington, women, black and white, flooded into the government to take those jobs. So my mother, for example, she rode on her suitcase from Norfolk, Virginia to Washington, D.C., to get her very first job. She was 18 years old, it was 1943, and so she is a Rosie the Riveter. If you worked on a farm, a lot of women who worked on farms with sharecropping, when their brothers left to go into the military, for example, they were left to run the heavy farm equipment. They helped feed America. So the short version of who Rosie the Riveter was the idea that any woman who did traditionally man's work during World War II is considered to be a Rosie the Riveter.
So the title of your film is Invisible Warriors, and when I first saw the title, it actually brought to mind the movie Hidden Figures from a few years ago, you know, about the women who were working with NASA, or well, what became NASA, you know, when they were Hidden Figures because people didn't know, you know, of their existence at the time. So why did you name your film Invisible Warriors?
These black women had essentially been edited out of history. I think there's a long-standing practice in our society, and it's still going on, that we are invisible, that African-American people are invisible. And I think in some ways African-American women are even more invisible. And so while African-American women have always worked, and I emphasize always, they have always worked outside the home as a group, that because they participated in this most consequential event, and 75 years later, most people do not know who they were or what they did or that they existed. And thus, they have been invisible like the Hidden Figures. Although I would add, and you know, I might get some pushback on this, that I see these 600,000 women as much more consequential to African-American progress in this country than the three women in Hidden Figures. And I say that, and that's not to diminish what the women in Hidden Figures did and accomplished, but these 600,000 African-American women changed the economics of the black community. They changed the economics for all subsequent generations of black people to come, particularly black women. And so because there were 600,000 of them, minimally 600,000 of them, I think they had a much more profound, direct, and meaningful impact on the black community, and particularly on black women.
How did you learn about it, and what was the inspiration for you to even make this film?
Well, it's a long and winding journey, like a lot of journeys in life. It wasn't a straight line. This all started with I would say the best way to describe it is to say I was spiritually compelled. I had an itch that I couldn't scratch. Something came over me almost 32 years ago that compelled me to go to Belgium, to go to Bastogne, Belgium. And this was something that was in my spirit, on my mind. I don't know where it came from, but it wouldn't let me go. And finally, almost 32 years ago, I went to Belgium. I went to Bastogne, which was the focal point of the World War II Battle of the Bulge. So I go into Bastogne. I go into a museum, and for the first time in my life, I see African-American soldiers in a museum. And prior to that, I never thought about black people in World War II. I hadn't really given World War II a whole lot of thought. But when I saw these black men in the diorama, I said, wow. And then I started researching and reading everything I could about African-American participation in World War II. I learned that there were 1.1 million black men and women who served in the military during World War II. That journey led me to Great Britain, and that's where I ran across the black women who were in the WACS, the Women's Army Corps, and that's also where I stumbled upon the 600,000 African-American Rosie the Riveters, doing research about black women in Great Britain. And after that, that's become my life journey.
Yeah, and that's fascinating that you say that, you know, you didn't really know any until you went overseas. You know, it's almost sad that you have to go overseas to learn about something that you should read about in your textbook. So let me ask you this. Who are some of the women that are featured in the documentary?
Well, probably the most notable is the late Dorothy Height. And during World War II, Dorothy Height, who was a protege of Mary McLeod Bethune, Dorothy Height played a major role in Washington, D.C. in terms of finding housing for black women. You know, the government sent out notices all across the country for black women and other women to come to Washington, but when black women arrived in Washington, there was no place for them to stay. You got to remember that Washington in the 1940s was racially segregated, and so all these women, like my mother, came to D.C., but there was no place for them to stay. So Dorothy Height was instrumental in agitating the federal government to do something about that. As a result, the federal government built three dormitories for black women. One of them is still in use on Slough Hall, on Howard University's campus. So that's a byproduct of Dorothy Height's efforts. But Dorothy Height was the only person I talked to who understood. She was the first person I interviewed for the documentary, and she was the only one who understood the historical significance of what I was doing. All the other women who were in the documentary, I had to talk into it, and I had to give them a brief history lesson because they never understood or thought about themselves as having done anything historically significant. So for them at the time, it was just a much, much better job, but they never saw themselves as being historically significant. I guess one of the other women I have, her name is Gwen Faison. Gwen Faison actually became mayor of Camden, New Jersey when she was 73 years old. And Gwen Faison came up from North Carolina and worked in RCA in 1942, making components for electronic components for the Navy. So, you know, all these women have these remarkable stories. Ruth Wilson here in Philadelphia turns 97 next Friday. She helped build an aircraft carrier, the USS Valley Forge. And even though she was from New Jersey, coming to Philadelphia was the first time in her life that she was allowed to come in, and she was a domestic, which is what 80% of more than 80% of all black women were either domestics or sharecroppers prior to the war. Ruth Wilson was a domestic, and when she came to Philadelphia, it's the first time in her life that she was allowed in the front door of the home she worked in. So all these women have these incredible stories, overcame incredible challenges, but they're exceptional women. They're loving women. They became mothers, grandmothers, great-grandmothers, and they're tough women, T-U-F-F tough. Yeah.
So how many women in all did you interview for the documentary?
I interviewed about 12. I used about 10 or 11. Since then, three have transitioned. So in February, when the film premiered, we had all of the surviving Rosies at the event, as well as three others who were not in the film, who were also at the event. And so we had the largest and only gathering of African-American Rosies since the end of World War II.
And a lot of these women, I know you said some of them have been domestics prior to the war. So I'm assuming most of them didn't have much education. Is that correct?
Well, they all, I'm thinking, all of them but one had high school diplomas.
Okay.
And so several of them after the war went on to become teachers.
Okay.
You know, they went to college and become teachers. There is one woman, Willie Mae Govan, from Childersburg, Alabama, who had to, she dropped out of school in 10th grade because she had to take care of her dying mother. But what's interesting about her, later on in life, she moved to Virginia, and she got her high school diploma when she was 60 years old. Huh. And she's now an ordained minister.
Oh.
Yeah, and so she's 93.
And in terms of their location, where were most of these women from that you interviewed?
Most of them were, I would say, between Virginia and Philadelphia.
Okay.
They were all within there, Washington, D.C., Baltimore, Philly, New Jersey, Virginia. Willie Mae Govan actually lives in Virginia, too. So all these women were, they were between Virginia and Philadelphia. All of them, most of them, I should say, grew up in the South, in the Jim Crow segregated South, as far south as Mississippi.
Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to UMES 30. Today's guest is Professor Gregory Cook. He is the director and producer of a new documentary film entitled Invisible Warriors: African-American Women in World War II. Professor Cook, how easy or difficult was it to track down these women that you interviewed? And then also, was it challenging getting them to open up and talk about some experiences from the past which may have been unpleasant to remember?
Well, I found them mostly by... one of the things I did, I would get in touch with senior facilities and ask people at those facilities to make announcements or put something in their newsletter, asking women if they had done anything, what they did during World War II. Some I got through indirect contacts, just a variety of ways. It wasn't, as I recall, we're talking, you know, it took me 9 years to do this. So I'm talking about something that happened 9, 10 years ago. But I don't recall it as being difficult finding them. But the challenge, as I said, was convincing them that they had done something worth talking about. As far as their own experiences, what they had in common, all of them talked openly about Jim Crow, about segregation, about what that meant to them. Only one of the women admitted being sexually harassed, and that was Willie Mae Govan. She worked for E.I. DuPont in Childersburg, Alabama, making gunpowder. And she talks in great detail about that experience. And she believes she lost her job there prematurely because she refused to give in to the advances. She had a great line in the film. She said, "At that time in Alabama, wasn't nothing free but a white man and a black woman." Yeah. And so, as an aside to that, or in addition to the point that she made about that, November 1944 was also the sexual assault of Recy Taylor, who was a young black woman in Alabama walking home from church, and six white men grabbed her, sexually assaulted her, stripped her down, left her on the side of the road, and they knew who the men were. The men admitted doing it, but nothing ever came. They were never prosecuted, or you know, nothing ever came of it. And what was also interesting about that is that's when Rosa Parks first turns up in World War II. Rosa Parks has been was active in civil disobedience, etc. Before most people know her from the 1955 bus boycott. But Rosa Parks was charged by the NAACP to go to Alabama to investigate the sexual assault of Recy Taylor. And Recy Taylor just passed away in December of, 17. So.
And, you know, I'm glad you mentioned Rosa Parks. In elementary school, we learned that the civil rights movement began in 1954 with Brown versus the Board of Education, the Supreme Court decision, which desegregated schools. And then obviously in the next year, 1955, you have the murder of Emmett Till, as well as Rosa Parks being arrested, and that leading to the Montgomery bus boycott and the introduction of Dr. King on the national stage. However, World War II is what really laid the groundwork for the civil rights and black power activity of the 1950s and 1960s. So, Professor Cook, can you talk briefly about the Double V campaign during World War II, and you know how that's in relation to the civil rights movement that comes down the road?
Right. Let me just say this real quick, and I want to elaborate on it. In my opinion, the civil rights movement started the day after the Civil War ended. But in terms of popular discussion, the Double V campaign was started in January, February by the Pittsburgh Courier newspaper, which was a major, major voice in the black community during World War II. And the Double V stood for Victory over Racism at Home and Victory over Fascism Abroad. And so it was a program that became nationwide and a rallying cry and a rallying point for black Americans. It galvanized the black community. And keep in mind, African Americans were overwhelmingly patriotic and loyal to America, but there was always this thing about, you know, things were not right. And World War II was an opportunity to begin a more aggressive push to change the social political conditions in America. And that's exactly what World War II did. And in my opinion, World War II was the most consequential event for black people in the 20th century. Because had there been no World War II, I suspect the civil rights movement would have happened eventually, but I think it would have happened much later in the century. And also keep in mind that by the time Rosa Parks did her thing in 55, young men who had gone overseas, young black men who had gone overseas, had been back here for 10 years and had been daily suffering the indignities of Jim Crow and segregation. So by the time Rosa Parks did her thing, these were now grown men who were ready to pick up the gauntlet and run with it. And so the civil rights movement was spearheaded by World War II veterans and black women, who many of whom were Rosie the Riveters. People like Medgar Evers, Ralph Abernathy, Fred Shuttlesworth, giants in the civil rights movement, were all in the military during World War II. And some of them, I think all of them, went overseas. I know Medgar Evers did, so did Fred Shuttlesworth.
In terms of the ladies that you interviewed, how much did their life change in the initial aftermath of the war? And also, did any of them have significant roles in the civil rights movement or in the Black Power movement that you know of?
Well, right after the war, you know, black service people, you know, men and women came back, and men, largely to the same country they had left. Jim Crow was still Jim Crow segregation, official discrimination was still largely the law of the land. And so for the Black Rosies, many of them, right after the war, went back to domestic work because that was all they could get. But I don't think most of them did not go back to the South. They stayed where they were in places like L.A., San Francisco, Detroit, Philadelphia, places like that. But immediately after the war, many of them went back to domestic service because that's all they could get. However, toward the end of the 1940s, into the 50s, and into the 60s, other opportunities opened up for black women. And so over the next 15, 20 years, black women largely disappeared from domestic service in America. I mean, it was no longer their primary means of employment because other segments of the economy opened up to black women. Black women who were in the military, many of them stayed in the military because you did get a better shake in the military. You did, one thing about being in the military, everybody got the same pay. If you were a sergeant, then all sergeants got the same pay, you know, regardless of what color you were, and that wasn't a condition to be found in the larger society. As far as participation in the civil rights movement, one woman, again, Willie Mae Govan, she was in Alabama. And Willie Mae Govan participated in civil rights marches, voter registration, and planning sessions in and around Montgomery. And she told me that her husband and her used to send money to Dr. King and Rosa Parks when all this stuff jumped off in 1955. She also told me she held voter registration drives in her house, planning sessions in her home. And because of that, they tried to kill her. Well, she told me a story one night. They tried to run her off the road. They knew who she was. They knew what she was doing, and people unknown tried to run her off the road. So she was the person who was actively, very actively involved in civil rights. But remember, she was in Alabama in the 1950s and 60s. The other women were up north, so it wasn't quite as oppressive, or it was oppressive in a different way up north than it was in Montgomery and Birmingham and other places in the South. But I think all the women came away from World War II, you know, with greater confidence in themselves and other women, and they knew what they were. They learned what they were capable of doing, and they realized all they really needed was to be given the opportunity.
There's the new African American History Museum that the Smithsonian has in Washington, D.C., and I know they do a good job in terms of highlighting black accomplishments during the war era, and you see the Tuskegee Airmen displayed. Do you know if they do anything in regards to these black Rosies?
I'm so glad you asked me that. I went into the museum a couple of years ago, and you know, I learned something that is very powerful, and that's not to say I'm not trying to position myself as a know-it-all or whatever, but there's an image in the museum of four women, two white, two black, sitting at a table making parachutes. And over top of the image is a placard that says it was a black-owned company. I have that image in my documentary, but I had no idea until I went into that museum that it was by a black black-owned company, and I had never heard of a black-owned company having a government contract during World War II. So that was kind of mind-blowing to me. But I would say that, in my opinion, and when I'm going to lobby for this, I think the Rosie the Riveters, in the context of American labor, should have a permanent exhibit there. Because of these women and their significance, in my opinion, they should have a permanent exhibit there for the Roses, for the African American Rosie the Riveters, whether they are in professional classes, bus drivers, or cops. All black women today stand on their shoulders.
Ultimately, what do you want viewers to take away from watching the movie?
The energy is changing in America and the world. Women are rising, and I believe that women of color, and particularly black women, will lead that change. World War II and the African-American Rosie the Riveters was the real beginning of that change in a big way. And it's a change that is accelerating globally. And I want people to know that black women, their mothers, grandmothers, great-grandmothers now, were major players in the most consequential event in human history. And they are no longer invisible.
Okay, and finally, how can listeners watch the film that we've been discussing?
What they can do, the film hopefully will be released in mass release by the end of this year. But people can go to www.invisiblewarriorsfilm.com and they can see a trailer. Or and on that website, they can get my email address is there, which is invisiblewarriorsfilm.com. or invisiblewarriorsfilm@gmail.com, and they can get in touch with me directly for more information. I can. I have a 7-minute introduction to the documentaries on Vimeo, but you need a password, and so I'm not really prepared to distribute it yet. There's still some things I'm working on, but I hope to have everything in place by the end of the year.
Okay, well, Professor, thank you again so much for talking with us this morning, and much success with this project.
Thank you for having me on.
We end each show with a segment called Parting Shots. Here I give my thoughts on something happening in the news, pop culture, or life in general that's piqued my interest. I recently watched all 4 hours of HBO's new documentary, Leaving Neverland, and Oprah's hour-long special on the documentary. In the film, two men, Wabe Robson and James Safechuck, tell stories of sexual abuse at the hands of the late pop icon and singer Michael Jackson from the time they were children through their teenage years. The film is extremely graphic and hard to sit through. Just 2 months earlier, I felt that same way as I watched the Lifetime docuseries Surviving R. Kelly. R. Kelly, the R&B and hip-hop singer, has been accused of having multiple inappropriate sexual relationships with teenage girls and underage women. So here's my question. Can you separate an entertainer's art or what they do professionally from their personal lives? I know many people who still watch The Cosby Show in spite of Bill Cosby's arrest. The accusations against Michael Jackson and R. Kelly have been around since the 1990s. It's 2019, and now we're having mass boycotts because of documentaries and the spirit of activism inspired by the Me Too. Why was there no similar outrage from the masses 10 years ago? Not saying that people weren't talking about this, but we didn't see this level of outrage. The next time you hear Thriller at a Halloween party or R. Kelly Step in the Name of Love at the family reunion, will you dance or will you sit that one out? And that's our show for the week. Thanks again to our guest today, Professor Gregory Cook. We do this every Sunday at 10:30 a.m. If you like the show, please tell your friends about it. Like us on Facebook and other forms of social media. A special shout out as always to Uncle Phil and Aunt Viv. Have a blessed day.